Hello and welcome to the World Soccer Talk podcast, your weekly dose of talking about watching soccer on TV, online, and apps. Coming up on episode 17 of the World Soccer Talk podcast, we discuss our opinions on the return of the new MLS TV season, how Fox Sports stooped to a new low this week, how PlayStation View customers are seeing double, as well as our opinions on whether Premier League TV viewing numbers are plateauing in the US or not. Kartik Krishnaya is my co-host. Kartik, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well, thank you. How are you, Chris?
Good. Yeah, I'm doing very well. Swansea's on the up and up, so I can't complain. So my name is Christopher Harris, aka The Gaffer, and we're going to jump right into what we've been watching. Kartik, what have you been watching this past week that's of note?
Well, I guess the return of MLS was the most significant thing that I watched this weekend, and had an article on World Soccer Talk talking about the highs and lows for Fox Sports and ESPN. Tried to focus on the She Believes Cup, but unfortunately, WSVN in my market did not show the US-England game, the Fox affiliate in the Miami-Fort Lauderdale market. I did get to watch USA-France, which was a very one-sided game, very impressive performance from the French team. The performances I expected to see from the French team 2 years ago at the World Cup. They played into the World Cup in 2015 brilliantly until they fell off in the Algarve Cup, and then in the World Cup allowed themselves to be beat by Germany, or lost on penalty kicks, but to be eliminated in the quarterfinals in a game where they completely controlled the possession, completely lost the game, and did not take their chances. And this game against the United States last night, as we record on Wednesday morning, they were brilliant. They took their chances in the first 10 minutes, put the game to bed. I know JP Del Cameron and Ali Wagner, who had a good call, good game for Fox, for FS1, were consistently trying to build a case for how the U.S. could get back into the match. But the U.S. Playing in a new formation in a 3-5-2 or a variation of the 3-5-2 didn't seem to have the sort of width you would expect coming out of that formation. Believe it or not, even with the wing backs or the wingers, and France was able to keep the ball, keep possession, and really boss the game. And then they got a third goal about midway through the second half, and put the game to bed. And if anything, they looked like they would get a fourth on the counter. So that was an interesting game to watch. And I felt like I think that the U.S. has had warning signs for several years that there needs to be some sort of reform. And I think it's reform within the system. I mean, we can talk about systems and playing styles, and Tom Cermani, who was the former manager who got sacked before Jill Ellis, tried to change the style of play and rely less on athleticism and more on kind of thinking and tactics. Now Jill Ellis is trying to transition the squad to a different way of playing. I think the reason it's not working, as well as some people would like, is that there are inherent structural defects in the U.S. soccer system that winning, and winning based largely on athleticism and the standout performances of a couple of superstar players, mask the problems for U.S. soccer. But several of us have been talking for many years about the fact that the big European nations seem to have caught the United States in women's soccer, France, Germany, England, and others. And had expected the World Cup in 2015 to be kind of the unmasking of the United States, where Sweden, where Australia, where France, Germany, England upstaged the U.S. That didn't happen. Mm-hmm. But it did happen in the Olympics in 2016 with Sweden eliminating the United States. And then these last two matches, particularly this France match, you see the gap that's beginning to open up between United States and those countries.
Yeah, and Kartik, I mean, for some of us, it's definitely not a surprise. I mean, this is definitely a U.S. women's team that's in transition. But, I mean, France in particular, I mean, that's, I forgot her name, but the right winger, I mean, storming down the wing, the speed, the agility, and then the crossing the ball into the box, completely tore the U.S. Women's team apart. But for me, though, too, I mean, watching these games was of interest, definitely. But, of course, I was looking at the TV production and TV broadcast, and I thought, while the U.S. women's team didn't do that well in this tournament, probably far from it, the production was great. I really enjoyed Tony DiTicco giving his analysis. And he, for the U.S. women's game against England, right off the bat, within the first couple of minutes, he dove right in and discussed like basically why Jill Ellis is playing a 3-5-2. And I thought that was a refreshing start that wasn't condescending to the audience, was going right in and talking at kind of a higher tactical level. And he was partnered by Jenny Taft. I think Jenny Taft did great. And like you mentioned too, Kartik, the commentary by JP Della Camera and Ali Wagner. For me, yeah, fantastic production. I too was disappointed in terms of WSVN in Miami not showing the game. But there were five other affiliates throughout the U.S. that didn't show the game, and that was Salt Lake City, Raleigh, Columbus, Augusta, and Birmingham, Alabama. So six Fox affiliates in total that didn't show the game and showed other programming. Maybe this one was just because it was maybe Fox.
Well, that's not really good to hear about Raleigh, because they are getting an NWSL team that starts play next month. In that market, with some of the players who would have been playing in this game being the featured players that are going to try and drive the audience in that market to North Carolina Courage games. And then Salt Lake City is high on the NWSL expansion list. So that's really discouraging that those two markets are on there in addition to Miami.
Yeah, and it may have been that just Fox, in terms of maybe scheduling this game, and didn't get the buy-in from those affiliates until it was too late. But definitely disappointing there. Going back to what you said earlier in terms of the MLS games, I did watch a few this weekend. The Portland Minnesota game was an enjoyable game to watch. Actually, all the games I watched were enjoyable from a football perspective in terms of football on the pitch. I liked it. And that's always the same reaction I usually get on opening weekend of Major League Soccer season, is it's good football. It's not that bad. It's watchable. It's decent. And with Fox on the Friday night broadcast of the Portland Minnesota game, they had some satellite issues, transmission issues, which is probably out of their control, but it is what it is. The Orlando New York City FC game on the Sunday, the stadium, Kartik, looks absolutely incredible, especially with the safe standing area behind the goal. Every fan, of course, wearing purple. And from a TV perspective, it was an amazing spectacle, because you had the atmosphere, you had the new stadium, the quality pitch, and also I loved the overhead shots that ESPN did, either from a plane or a helicopter, kind of just above the stadium, kind of just showing what's happening on the pitch from a distance. And then the Sunday night game, the Atlanta, New York Red Bulls, again, another fantastic atmosphere. The stands are really close to the field, and the level of play was entertaining. I think all in all, I mean, that's always the struggle with MLS, is that, you mean, it's longevity, is that what's the incentive to continue watching through the summer months? You mean, especially when usually over 50% of the teams make the playoffs anyway. That's the challenge to me, is that they have all of the right ingredients, but perhaps they have the wrong recipe in terms of the way that the league is structured, where it doesn't give incentives to actually continue watching throughout the entire season to see who finishes in first or second. It's okay. It's all about making the playoffs, and that kind of defeats the purpose.
Yeah, and we've seen the last two seasons, teams that did not perform well, particularly well in the regular season, both teams came on late, Portland and Seattle, and because playoffs were structured, when the playoffs said Seattle, I thought might win MLS Cup. I had them in the finals against the Red Bulls, and it turned out it was against Toronto, but they were very poor for most of the season. They were one of the worst teams in MLS for much of the season. That really didn't change. They had a good win against Dallas in early July, but that really didn't change till September. And that was the similar situation with Portland, where they were struggling. They were pretty mediocre until they went to Los Angeles next to last week of the 2015 season, went to the Galaxy and won 5-2, and then went on a tear and won the MLS Cup. So it takes away the relevance from these early season games, the size of the playoffs. The flip side is, unfortunately, when you don't have relegation, you have to have as large a playoffs as possible in order to keep some interest at the bottom of the table. So MLS folks won't admit it, but this is a byproduct of them not having relegation, is the fact they have such a large playoffs. Because I think there are people around MLS that understand this, that the playoffs probably should be 4 or 6 or 8 teams, not 12 teams. Mm-hmm. But they have they keep some sort of interest in games for teams that are toward the bottom of the table because of where they are in terms of being a close league and not having relegation and not having any relevance for teams at the bottom of the table. Now, as it turns out, the last few years, there have been some teams that are so bad, they're out of the playoff race for all intents and purposes with 6 weeks left to go in the season. But generally, that wouldn't be the case because they let so many teams into the playoffs.
Yeah, I agree. And then from this past weekend, too, in terms of some of the other games I watched, just to throw them out there, Kartik, and feel free to join in if you watched any of these, too. Augsburg against Leipzig on Friday. We had Keith Costigan and Eric Rinaldo announcing. I thought it was a good first half. It was a very physical game, lots of fouls back and forth, very, very competitive. And one of the stars on display that day on that match was Naby Keita. Had a really excellent performance. On Saturday, then, I was watching the Man United Bournemouth match, as well as the Swansea Burnley game. And this one, Kartik, this really kind of, we've talked about this for the last several weeks. Video assistant referees, in these cases, are badly needed. The Man United against Bournemouth game, actually, you could argue perhaps, maybe they're not needed because with the FA coming down and on, Zlatan and Tyrone Mings and issuing kind of these bans, perhaps, you mean, maybe in this case it's not needed. But anyway, this game had a little bit of everything. There was a save penalty. There was controversial decisions. There was a red card. I think Bournemouth's, one of their coaches was sent to the stands at halftime. There were handball incidents galore in this match. And I think the only thing that was missing was a spectacular goal. But in terms of the video assistant referee, I mean, combing through all the stuff that happened, I mean, they would have had I don't know how much time they would have taken if they had a video assistant referee to go through the Zlatan elbow, Tyrone Mings stamping on Zlatan's head, and then other off-the-ball incidents too. This is a really, a game that Man United desperately wanted to win to kind of get into the top four, and failed. And fair play to Bournemouth for sticking in there for most of the match with 10 players, but a very, very eventful game to watch. And then you had the Swansea-Burnley game, which I watched. And actually, this last couple of months, at least, I think to me at least, I'm biased in this case, but Swansea's been a really entertaining team to watch because they've been, you know, on the attack, lots of goals, very entertaining. But in this match, in the first half, there was an incident where Sam Vokes, the Burnley striker, handled the ball in the box. And the referee, Anthony Taylor, awarded a penalty kick against Swansea to Burnley. And Burnley struck the penalty home and got that goal. But, I mean, a horrible decision. Anthony Taylor, at halftime, said he made an honest decision and thought it was a Swansea player that handled the ball when it wasn't, in fact. But again, more refereeing controversy and another instance where if we did have a video assistant referee, that's something that could be sorted out in a matter of seconds, basically, to say that, no, that should not have been the penalty kick. That should have been a free kick for Swansea. And then, Kartik, Behind the Badge, I'm not sure if you had a chance to watch that this weekend, the first episode. I watched that on Saturday. The one on West Bromwich Albion, episode one, was really, I mean, to me, some good insights into how different Tony Pulis is as a coach, and how his unconventional approach is refreshing, not only to his players, but I think to the league as a whole. It's old fashioned in some ways, but he is very kind of a man manager, and also focuses on hard work and set plays, I mean, especially free kicks, throw-ins, etc. From this episode, to me at least, there was nothing mind-blowing, but it was enjoyable to watch, and it did a good job of laying down the foundation and giving some background on West Bromwich Albion, and I learned a few things about the Albion in terms of the supporter base and some of the songs that they sing. How about you, Kartik? Any insights on that one?
Part about the match day program is most fascinating because there's a template that most clubs use, and match day programs traditionally very similar place to place. They're indispensable parts of British football culture, but they are generally the same. At West Brom, they use rock music lyrics, rock music history as an inspiration to generate the theme for each match day program. I thought that was one of the neatest things I've seen. It really in any of these Premier League behind the scenes or behind the badge shorts or Premier League download series that we've seen on NBC.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they went into some background in terms of some of the program covers and how they've been using album covers as kind of inspiration for some of these covers. That was interesting. I thought that was a novel take. One of the things, though, too, I mean, Kartik from the Watford, Crystal Palace, and now the West Brom one is that it is kind of getting into kind of predictable, though. I mean, it's kind of the interview, the guy that does the program, the interview. The kit man and the interview. I mean, it's the same type of people that have similar jobs. I mean, they all have probably different opinions in terms of how they do their work, but it is getting a little bit predictable in terms of the formula that they're putting together for these Behind the Badge series.
Yeah. Yeah, that's certainly true, which is why, I liked seeing some of the outside novelty things they did with Watford, and now they've done. Hopefully we'll do some with West Brom in the remaining. I assume it's three parts left in the series, right? They've all been four parts.
Exactly. And then Sunday was the Spurs Everton match, and what a crazy ending to this match! It was. It felt like a basketball game where the most of the excitement was in the last 5 or 10 minutes of the match, and there were two goals in injury time. It looked like a very comfortable win for Spurs, but then Everton bounced back and caused some nervous. Twitchy bombs, I guess, at White Hart Lane, but crazy ending. But overall, I guess an exciting game.
The goal that Dele Alli scored, that Harry Winks played on that free kick, that's one of the best goals. I mean, I know there are other ways of spectacular goals you'll see, but that's one of the best executed set piece moves you'll ever see in your life. That was fantastic.
Yeah, and it's one of those ones he made it look so easy, but if anyone's played the game of soccer, you know how difficult that is in terms of just the touch to get that into the corner. It was absolutely sensational. And then we had the West Ham United against Chelsea match on the Monday, and to me, Kartik, this was such a one-sided game. I mean, Chelsea could have won this one 5-0 pretty comfortably. The scoreline suggests otherwise, but it was a walk in the park for Chelsea.
Yeah, very important to note that against the four teams, the big four, if you would call them that, Man City, Arsenal, Chelsea, and Man United, last season West Ham took 12 points at home at the Bowling Ground. And this season they took, I believe, zero against those four teams, or have zero at this point against those four teams. Yeah. I think it is zero, right? They played all four of them. And that's, that is to me a reflection of the ground. The ground is still, and maybe it's an excuse. I've made this excuse. I made it on another show I was on yesterday about why the host of that show grilled me, well, you're a big Pochettino fan, I'm a Pochettino fan also, but how do you explain Spurs' disaster in Champions League? How do you explain that? And then how do you explain them being eliminated in the Europa League? And my explanation, maybe it's simplistic, maybe it's naive, maybe it's defensive of Pochettino, is Wembley. He's playing in a stadium like that, and the opposition gets up for games at Wembley. Mm-hmm. And you lose your home pitch advantage, which I think Spurs very clearly lost in Europe. I think for West Ham, very similar at the London Stadium. And unfortunately, this game, we had another incident of hooliganism, much like we did when they played Chelsea in the League Cup, and much like we did in some of the early matches. Props to John Champion and Danny Higginbotham for calling that out right there and then on the broadcast, and making reference to what was going on, not white. Watching it, but again, security at London Stadium, a problem. I found more interest in this match. Was not interesting, as you mentioned. It was a one-sided match. I found more interest in NBC's presentation before and after the match. So they had on Premier League Live Monday the same nonsense, I call it, with the surface tablets with Robbie Uhrle and Kyle Martino going through Lanzini's movement and Fabregas's movement and very kind of basic stuff that they would point out anyway in the normal chain of events, chain of broadcasts. In fact, it's stuff that Kyle Martino has pointed out regularly about Fabregas. He's now just using this tool to illustrate it. So to me, that was quite annoying. I thought that there was a really good conversation between. Yes.
Actually, just going back to the tablet thing just one more thing is one thing that they did different. I completely agree with you. To me, it's It's horrible that they're doing it. I just dislike it incredibly. But one of the things they did differently this week, I don't know if you noticed it, was that Robbie Musto, they basically kind of hung on to him for like maybe like one or two more seconds and showed him with his stencil, I guess, touching the actual tablet surface, and then it went straight to kind of showing the video of the Lanzini, you mean, kind of dissection of his tactical analysis. But I just thought it was interesting that they kind of probably pretended that Robbie was actually clicking on the actual screen in order to show it. But yeah, it's really cheap ploys by them. I'm just really disappointed in that.
Yeah, and so that was a low point for that pregame show, but then a high point was just a few minutes later, Lee McHugh and Steve Bauer had a really good conversation where they hit a number of topics, and this, I think, is the kind of thing that's missing from NBC shows on the weekend. And I know there's probably a lack of availability of talent to come on and discuss it immediately before and after matches, or when they do match of the day, which we know they record soon after the matches are over, even though it airs much later in the evening. The time they record it is generally the time that it airs when they do the few live match of the days they do every season. I'm not sure if they've done one this season, actually, but last season they had a few that were live and were on at 2:30 or 3:30 Eastern time. So that was a really insightful conversation between McHugh and Bauer. But I was thinking, gosh, this is what we're missing. I mean, I complain about kind of the monotony now of NBC shows on Saturdays and Sundays. This is the element we're missing. And yeah, they pull Neil Ashton in from time to time, but he's busy reporting on whatever match at whichever venue he's at. And in the case of Bauer, we know he's got BBC commitments, on the weekends, match of the day commitments. So, maybe they just don't have the availability of talent, but that was a really good segment to watch. So I was happy with that. And, then, of course, Tuesday, it's such a tired subject now, but there was obviously Arsenal. They got beat again 5-1. They lost 10-2 on aggregate to Bayern. The most interesting piece from that entire game, I think, was after the match, where Alexi Lalas on Fox called out Alexis Sanchez and Petr Cech for their seeming amusement after the fifth goal for Bayern. I see this both ways. I think Lalas was probably right to call him out, but at the same time, Cech and Sanchez are the two winners, real bona fide winners on that Arsenal team that have won at other places and at their previous stops in their career and know how to win big matches. And we're probably frustrated and embarrassed, and maybe the laughter came because of that. Maybe it was exacerbated laughter. Maybe it was just a defense mechanism. If it was, if they were mocking the team, well, then yeah, Lalas is correct. But we really don't know. I'm thinking maybe it was the opposite. But then this became the talking point on ESPN FC, and then also on ESPN FC. I'd love to get your take on this, Chris. Craig Burley said enough about this. We feel bad for Wenger. He's done such a great job. He's been such an ambassador for English football. He's not Mother Teresa. He's not the Pope. He's not a guy who's invented some sort of mechanism for crops to feed the world or bottling water for the poor in Africa. This is a football manager for heaven's sakes. Get off it. Okay. It's time for him to go. So, It was a classic rant,
yeah.
But from a football perspective, then I guess that applies to everybody in football. You really shouldn't feel sorry for anyone. He said, look, this guy makes £7 million a year,
right,
and he's a football manager, okay?
Yeah, it's the same thing about Claudio Ranieri. I mean, it's a job. At the end of the day, it's a job. And, of course, for we supporters who have much closer allegiances to our clubs, we're not getting paid millions of dollars by any means, but it's a different relationship. And to those managers, it is a job. And, if any workforce, if, Kartik, your place, my place, at any place, if someone's not performing to the level that they're, of the expectations, then it's time for a heart to heart conversation to see if they're the fit.
Yeah. And I think Burley probably won me over with that because I've been on the fence. I've said, yeah, probably Wenger should go, but I feel bad about it because, again, I'm in this sentimental thing. Oh, a few people have meant as much the Premier League English football as Arsene Wenger. And I do hang on to the fact that Wenger loves Arsenal so much he turned down what least at this point appear to be their jobs. Maybe they weren't at the time. Mm-hmm. Barcelona, or not, maybe not Barcelona, Real Madrid, PSG, the French national team, to stay at Arsenal, and that he's been such a custodian of the club, he's looked after their finances, unlike other men who'll blow through money, or Harry Redknapp, for example, and then just move on to the next job. So I feel bad in that sense, but yeah, Burley's right. He's just a football manager. We're treating him like he's, like he is the Pope, or he's Mother Teresa. And they, a lot of that in the English press, but I think there are so many people English press who don't know football and English football with Wenger. So it's a tough thing.
Yeah, it is interesting because it seems to me, at least from the Arsenal board, that they wanted to give him to the end of the season and say, okay, let's give him a chance to go out on a high and go deep in the Champions League, or let's see if he can go out on a high in the Premier League or one of the cup competitions. And they've given him the rope and he hasn't come through with that. And it's just the same old stuff. It's definitely time for him to go. I mean, it's one of those things that I think Arsenal have given him plenty of opportunities, and probably the money was there to spend on other players if he wanted to, but he's been very stubborn in terms of his methods, which have worked incredibly well in the early days of Arsenal, but in the last half a decade, not so much. So I think it's time for him to depart, and it's probably good timing on his part too. I think he's probably he's probably open to having maybe a change of heart or doing something different than he has in the past, perhaps a new lease in life, so to speak. So, Kartik, one of the things about this Arsenal-Bayern Munich match that came to light was now something that we've raised before on the World Soccer Talk podcast. This is going back a few weeks ago for the Man City against Monaco game. And at the time, kind of gave everyone a heads up in terms of keep an eye on Fox Sports, because it looked like they were having John Strong and Stu Holden pretending to be at the stadium. And with the lighting and the camera angle and the green screen, basically kind of I was looking at that saying, okay, that looked very much like they were doing it from the studio. Well, it turns out to be that for the Arsenal-Bayern match, they did the same exact thing again. This time they had John Strong and Stu Holden dressed up in suits, ties, jackets, in front of a green screen. And on the green screen, they had a live video shot of the Emirates Stadium. And they pretended to be in London, in North London, at the stadium. And, even during the broadcast too, there's a couple of times that John Strong kind of referenced, kind of almost hinting that they were at the stadium just in some of the remarks he made. But we went ahead and posted the video on worldsoccertalk.com, as well as an article kind of going into more detail. But really, it's, to me at least, it's a very dishonest move, to try to trick and mislead the viewers into thinking that your talent is actually at the stadium when they're not. They're in Los Angeles in a Fox Sports studio, just calling the game off the monitor. And I have no problem with talent calling games off the monitor. The problem I have is misleading the actual viewers into thinking that these people are actually at the stadium when they're not. They're 6,000 miles away. I don't know if Kartik, did you catch any of that pre-match?
I did not. As I said last week, I'm less bothered about it than you are, because I know there are limitations on Fox's budget and such. Now, the thing that concerns me is John Strong is one of the very best, if not the best, in the United States. Is he going to get burnt out by calling all these matches? I mean, I don't know how he's preparing. He did a game Friday night. He did a game Friday night. Yep. In Minnesota and Portland. Then he did, and I understand Portland games are easier for him to prepare for because he knows that team so well, and that's the team he worked with prior to moving to NBC and then to Fox. Then he goes cross country. He and Lawless calls the Atlanta New York game Sunday night, and I had indicated in my piece that I felt like Lawless's analysis became very stale in the second half of that game. I thought he had had a good opener in Portland, but then didn't do very well in Atlanta because he's calling a second game in three nights. And 3,000 miles away, or 2,500 miles away. Then Strong flies back to Los Angeles, sits down with Stu Holden, and has to call Arsenal Bayern. Now, I understand he called the first leg, so might have been prepared. And again, John Strong's a professional. He did a good job. I don't know if he's doing Barcelona PSG today. He might be. He's certainly probably going to do a Europa League game on Thursday. And then he's got an MLS game, Portland and the Galaxy, on Sunday. That's a lot of games to call. And I don't know if there's a Bundesliga game. I don't think there is, but there might be a Bundesliga game there that he's calling somewhere. That's a lot of soccer to call in 1 week. And we know, I have to look at the MLS schedule, but it's already come up in talking to some folks. Is it possible he's going to call the Champions League final in person in Cardiff and then fly back to the United States because it's in Cardiff? It's not in Moscow or in Kiev or someplace really very far east. It's in Cardiff, which makes it very easy to get back to the States. Very, very easy, particularly if there's a game on the East Coast. Is he going to end up calling the MLS game the next night?
Yeah, I'm more concerned about John Strong, basically kind of the image of him, basically kind of being presented as in being at the Emirates Stadium, pretending to be there, lying to the viewers. I mean, breaking the trust between the broadcaster and the viewer and destroying that trust. I mean, John Strong to me is definitely the number one American commentator in the country, bar none. I mean, he's number one.
Yeah, no, it's not even a debatable point.
Right. And Stu Holden to me is up there. He's probably in the top three, kind of the best, US, co-commentators or, analysts. And the two of them work together really, really well. But to me, I worry more so about their career legacy in terms of every time they're in front of a camera, are we to now look at the broadcast and go, okay, are they actually at the stadium or are they in a studio with a green screen? And to me, it's just really a dishonest approach. And I'm sure that John Strong and Stu Holden had no say in the matter, that either it was, I don't know, David Nathanson or Eric Shanks or John T. Whitehead or one of the executives at Fox Sports, and perhaps all three of them, that said, okay, this is what you're going to do. This is how we're going to set it up and just do it. So I feel sorry for John Strong and Stu Holden because it does hurt their image. I mean, to me as a viewer, the people that see this, they can see right through it, and they will question in the future, you mean, are they actually even at the stadium or not? I think in terms of, we've seen this from Derek Gray too. Derek Gray was doing, when I say we see this from Derek Gray, I mean, in terms of a lot of travel time and burnout factor and doing a lot of games, it's doable. And I think John Strong, I mean, he has to kind of be extremely careful in terms of, not trying to get burnt out. And especially with these Champions League games too. I mean, like, let the world feed do it. I mean, he doesn't have to be pretending to be in a studio in LA with Stu Holden. Let the world feed do it. Give him a break for a few days. And then let him come back later in the week for the MLS game. I have no problem with that. But I wouldn't be surprised. I'd be very surprised actually if he's not at the Champions League final in Cardiff. I'm pretty sure he'll be there with Stu Holden, live and in the flesh.
But, and I think what Fox needs to do now, because they've lost Champions League rights, obviously, after the 2018 World Cup, and that goes to Turner Sports, is that they need to use Champions League as a way to build excitement for their FIFA properties, Confederations Cup this summer, World Cup in 2018. And because of that, I think they might even be more incentivized to send John Strong over there than they would otherwise. I think they have to look at it now as a way to feed, the coverage. And they did that. They gave Gus Johnson, I know neither of our favorite characters, favorite experiments, but they gave Gus Johnson some Premier League games in 2013, knowing they were losing the rights to add that.
Right.
NBC was picking it up on the other side of the summer. So they might use these opportunities to hone John Strong and Stu Holden even stronger as a team now, because I assume when they get to World Cup coverage, Lawless, who is John Strong's partner in MLS matches, will be in the studio, and then they will have Holden paired with Strong as one of the top teams. So maybe this is a chance to create a really good American number one or number two team at Fox when it comes to the World Cup, which I think is good for the sport in this country. Mm-hmm. So, but again, I'm concerned a little bit about the burnout factor, and I was concerned about that last summer with two summers ago, 2015, with Rob Stone when you had, or was it last summer? No, it was two summers ago, when you had the Women's World Cup and Gold Cup on the heels of one another.
Yeah. Yeah, and speaking of Rob Stone too, I mean, it was actually refreshing to have Kate Abdo hosting the Tuesday broadcast of the Champions League on Fox. That was nice to see. But going back, Kartik, to what you said in terms of Fox using the Champions League to promote their FIFA properties, and other properties. They're already doing it. I mean, pre-game two on Tuesday, they had an interview with Bruce Arena about the Gold Cup. Then they had an interview with Grant Wall about U.S. soccer's new anthem policy in terms of U.S. National anthem. So they're trying to get as much juice as possible out of the UEFA Champions League pre-game to cross-promote the other properties. And actually, maybe Kartik, maybe you're right. Maybe they'll be doing even more of that too, and we'll get less and less UEFA Champions League pre-game and more promotion of other properties. All right, Kartik. So, and actually, let me add one more thing too. So I did watch Pumas against Santos Laguna on Sunday, I think it was. Yeah, Sunday on Facebook Live. And again, it was Ramses Sandoval and Nico Cantor doing the commentary. And again, enjoyable. I just really enjoy it. And I think Nico Cantor, as a commentator in English, sounds fantastic, sounds very energetic. And I think it's perfect for Facebook Live. So we shall see. I know Don Garber this week in an interview hinted that there'll be a major announcement soon coming in regards to MLS games being available via social media. The hints so far have been that it's more Twitter that's more likely, but who knows? Maybe it'll be Facebook Live. But I think when that comes, that'll be that's a good move on MLS's part. So, Kartik, before we move into the next segment, I do want to mention our sponsor, SeatGeek. And buying tickets to sports and concerts can be way too complicated at times, but there is a better, simpler way to buy, and that's with SeatGeek. SeatGeek is the smartest, easiest way to get tickets to live events. With SeatGeek's seamless mobile experience, you can buy and sell tickets in just two taps. SeatGeek helps you find the best seats at the best prices, fully guaranteed. And there's nothing quite like seeing your favorite team or musician in person, and SeatGeek will get you closer to the action for a great value. I have the SeatGeek app on my phone, and it's by far the easiest way that I've found to shop for tickets. I've been looking at the Gold Cup for the summer, and so I can be anywhere with my phone, and with just a few taps, I can instantly find seats. And it's designed to make your ticket buying experience easier than ever. It saves you time and money by searching multiple ticket sites to compare prices and find amazing deals. And to get the most bang for your buck, SeatGeek grades every ticket based on values to help you immediately identify the best seats that fit your budget. Plus, every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with full confidence. Now, best of all for listeners, you get a $20 rebate off your first SeatGeek purchase. And to get your $20 rebate on tickets, just go ahead and download the SeatGeek app, go to the settings tab, and then click on add a promo code. Enter promo code WSTPOD, and then SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase. Now, Kartik, in terms of TV streaming news this week, PlayStation View has added a multi-view feature to allow you to watch three channels at once. The bad news is it's only available on PS4, but the good news is that, and we've seen this on similar, on Fox Sports Go and Fox Soccer to Go and ESPN3, kind of the mosaic or the multi-view, where, so on PlayStation View, you can have your main game or main program featured in kind of basically taking up about three quarters of the screen. And then on the remaining sections on the screen, you can see kind of small, not thumbnails, bigger than thumbnails, but small channels also at the same time. So you could conceivably have three games on at once and have your main one that you're focused on, and then on the other two have them kind of on the background kind of playing, so that if you do want to switch action, Champions League is a perfect example of that, being able to, you mean, from Napoli, Real Madrid to Arsenal against Bayern Munich, you can kind of switch back and forth with that. What about Kartik, any other news from the TV streaming news space?
Yeah, in fact, there are a couple pieces of news this week. Americans, this is not going to surprise anyone, but Americans have fewer TVs on average than they did in 2009. In 2009, the average per household was 2.6 TVs. In 2015, the number dropped to 2.3. It would be interesting to see the how many smartphones and how many laptop computers are in each household too, because that I'm sure has increased in that 8-year period since 2009.
Yeah, and also this week too, British TV streaming service BritBox launched in the US. This is one we talked about, I think, back in October or November. We wanted to pay close attention to it because it's a joint partnership between the BBC and ITV. But unfortunately, so far from what we've been able to tell, that there's no soccer on it. So you can't expect any match of the day from BBC or programming from ITV. So it looks like it's not going to be a hit for soccer fans. But if you enjoy your British dramas or comedies or science fiction and shows that you like to see on UK TV, that's something that's worth checking out. And they're offering a free trial at this moment. And then, Kartik, any other news?
Yeah, this is not surprising. However, now we have some degree of confirmation that it's going to happen. Awful announcing reporting that layoffs are expected at ESPN, including on-air talent. And that's something that I think was coming and has been coming. They have a lot of soccer personnel that do ESPN FC and do other soccer-related, the boot room, etc., other things that are not necessarily connected to games and live sporting events. And my guess is that it's much easier to cut people from studio shows than live sporting events. So let's see what happens with the ESPN FC program. I don't think the program's in jeopardy, but maybe some of the personnel's in jeopardy, and see how that shakes down in the next few months.
Yeah, definitely one to watch because it could impact possibly soccer coverage in terms of some of the personnel that we see and weekly basis or daily basis. And then, Kartik, actually, do you want to take the next one too in terms of some of the TV numbers?
Yeah, so Fox Sports 1 lost 565,000 households in February 2017. ESPN lost 422,000. The previous month we'd seen ESPN had lost more households than FS1, so it kind of goes back and forth. NBCSN, which had a horrible loss in January of 2017, gained 1.3 million households in February. The assumption they were meeting some cable system that wasn't picking, did not have them as part of, probably had them on a premium package, bumped them up to a basic package. That's my assumption with that. But they gained 1.3 million households, which is great news for the Premier League.
Yeah, definitely, most definitely. So moving on to the next segment, and that's soccer TV ratings. And a couple different numbers from the MLS so far that we've gotten thus far. So the MLS opener on Friday night between Portland and Minnesota, that was on FS1, was an entertaining game to watch, but the numbers on the viewing side, not so great. There was 235,000 people across FS1 and Fox Deportes combined. And I just got an email, actually, from Univision. So Univision's broadcast of the game, that was the FC Dallas against Galaxy on Saturday, is the most viewed MLS match on any network last week, regardless of language, and had 509,000 people watch that one. So over half a million, and that one was on Unimas. And so actually better numbers there from Unimas, and we should be getting the numbers, I think, from ESPN and Fox for Sunday's broadcasts, and we'll be posting those on World Soccer Talk as soon as we have those. Kartik, what about some of the other numbers?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I thought the numbers were disappointing, really, for MLS. But we had 728,000 viewers for U.S. England in terms of the women's game that was on Fox over the air on Saturday. Now, again, we've gone through the number of affiliates who didn't show that game. So 728,000, it's a low number for network television, but there were affiliates who didn't show the game still. You would have liked a higher number, 5 o'clock on a Saturday. That's a prime spot. 614,000 on NBCSN at 12:30 p.m. Eastern time on Saturday for Arsenal Liverpool. That's a high number for NBCSN. It is not a high number for that time slot. Those games usually being on NBC over there, not a high number for an Arsenal Liverpool game, but still it beat every MLS telecast this weekend, worth noting, although it did fall behind several Liga MX telecasts. So, those are the other numbers from the weekend. I'd be curious to see, the numbers for, Arsenal Liverpool, if it had been on NBC over the year. I think that could have pushed a million.
Yeah, it would have been close for sure. We'll have to wait. Maybe next season we'll see what those numbers are. But yeah, the Liga MX numbers that will be reported on worldsoccertalk.com, I think on Thursday. So keep an eye out for those. And actually all of the games, we'll have the numbers for those on the website. Moving on to our listener mailbag. And the first message is from SunnySoCalRob25 from Twitter. And he says, I wanted to share my thoughts on one of the old episodes with Jonathan Tannerwald from about 2 weeks ago. The topic of the Foxes pre-game Champions League coverage, Mr. Tannenwald stated that Grant Wall breaks news of MLS US soccer. Not saying the information is irrelevant or not, but Fox could have Grant on the Talking Heads shows the 6 hours prior to Champions League pre-game begins. But we know how FS1 feels about soccer on their channel from the past few years. This is one of many reasons why many soccer fans are happy that Fox is going to not continue its Champions League coverage after next year with Turner Sports. Thank you for your time and the great work you guys do on the pod and the website. So Rob, definitely thank you for that message, sending that in. And I agree. I mean, it's one of those things.
That's a great point.
Yeah. I mean, they do have 6 hours of Talking Head shows that could be, I mean, Grant, if it is breaking news, break it. Don't hold it and wait until like 2:10 Eastern time. And then interrupt Champions League pregame coverage and have, like, I mean, 10 or 15 minutes of news that, I mean, for the MLS audience, it is interesting. For those outside of MLS, not so much most of the time. But yeah, definitely great points there from SunnySoCalRob25 on Twitter. The next one is also from Twitter. This is from Jason Hicks. And this one, Kartik, maybe it's a little bit more for you on this one. He says, I'm in Baltimore. I'm a DC United fan. I'm supposed to be able to get games on my over-the-air signal, which is 24-3. I'm also in the MLS live blackout zone, so I can't watch games. MLS is losing the home market. And he's probably mentioning, too, as far as like DC United, the home games, that he's in the area, he has MLS live, but they're blacked out, both on MLS live and on over-the-air. What are your thoughts on this,
yeah, topic? Yeah, that's disappointing. I mean, that's a problem. That's ultimately MLS has to get past that sort of thing, and they have to somehow balance the local considerations for broadcast and the ability of people to stream the game at their convenience on different platforms. They have to balance that, and they could not figure it out yet. I'm not surprised by Jason's comment. I'm just disappointed by it.
Yeah, and the other thing too for Jason too to consider is that you could use a VPN, a virtual private network, and then log in through MLS Live that way. I mean, you're still a paying subscriber, but you could log in from a different location in the US, and then I mean, you're paying for the service, you're paying for MLS Live, and it's ridiculous that you're not able to actually watch your DC United game through a service that you're paying good money for. So anyway, that's the suggestion there. Last but not least, we have a question from email, actually a comment through email, and this is from our listener, Dave Brunk. And he says, your in-depth analysis of Turner Sports was very interesting as well. Many points that you both made I had not considered. I'm definitely in the camp of they can't do any worse than Fox. It seems to me in general that Fox hires the most annoying personalities in sports. Cowherd, Sharp, Rose, Lalas, and tries to create fake conflicts in the studio discussions. Who enjoys that? I find the mute button quickly. Any thoughts there, Kartik?
Yeah, I think that he speaks for a lot of people when he says that. And this is part of the reason why, again, you said last week you were kind of taken aback by the amount of jubilation you saw when you broke the story, when World Soccer Talk broke the story that Turner had gained the UCL rights at Fox's expense. But this is part of it. I mean, these are the sorts of things that drive people away from Fox. And I know of several people, including our former co-host on the show, Morgan Green, who openly brag about not knowing Spanish, but watch games in Spanish if they're on another network, particularly Copa America this past summer, if they're on another network, and they can avoid watching POC. So Morgan, for example, watched the entire Copa America on Univision, even though he doesn't know Spanish. And that's the general sentiment of a lot of hardcore soccer fans.
Right. Yeah, it is strange, though, at the end of the day, I mean, to think about it in terms of Fox has this vision of what they think is best for their audience in terms of the way that they have these fake debates and fake conflicts where they kind of rehearse a lot of the things they're going to say and then take sides, even if they don't agree with the sides, but they're taking opposing sides just to have a fake debate and then have these broadcasts. And I mean, I don't know, most of the opinions I hear, the vast majority of people are just saying like, I hate this type of coverage, but they continue to do it. And it's not just soccer. It's across the board. It's just in this day and age, I mean, I don't know, with fake news and all that stuff, it just seems so fake. And, basically it just seems fake. It just seems like something that's, I don't want to watch that. I want to hear real opinions from real people saying what they believe. And actually, in some ways, that's kind of how I feel that Eric Winalda gets shafted, because he has strong opinions, and give him a few minutes and he's convincing. He has some, whether you like him or not, he's a very, intelligent person that understands soccer probably better than most people in the United States, especially from a coaching perspective and player development, et cetera. But he keeps on getting held back, even though that Fox is supposed to be this very kind of debate-heavy type of network. But then he gets cast aside where he doesn't fit into this this approach that they have, where it's just, you know, give me 20 seconds of opinion about why Wenger should be sacked or not. And it's hard to do it in 20 seconds. You miss something. You lose out. Ah. All right, that's my rant for the day. So let's move on to the next segment, which is our final segment of the week. And that is a topic that, Kartik, you and I have been talking about for a few weeks offline. And that is the question whether or not Premier League viewer numbers have plateaued. And if they have, which all the indications are basically looking at the numbers in terms of the TV viewership, that we're not getting some monster numbers like we have in the past, and it seems to have plateaued where it's comfortable week in, week out, but we're not seeing huge gains. Why is that? Why are the numbers seemingly plateauing and not increasing as soccer becomes more and more popular, I'd argue, in the United States? Kartik, what are your thoughts on this and kind of some of your insight?
A couple of things. First off, I'm not sure soccer is becoming more popular in the United States. I think we might have reached a plateau or a kind of level for now. Now, that could always change after the next World Cup. That could always change due to some sort of event that drives interest in it. But I think we're looking at a pretty static situation now. We're not losing fans either. But I think it's pretty, we're not gaining fans at the rate we were from, let's say, 2009 to 2013, 2014, or through the 2014 World Cup. We're not gaining fans at that rate. So I think that's the first point. I think this is an unfortunate thing, but the World Cup, I think, well, let's see what Fox does with it as far as promotion, with the World Cup being off of ESPN and Disney networks and onto Fox networks, News Corp networks, doesn't do a whole lot to drive the sport. I have to go back to Sunny SoCal Rob's point. I think there is a bit of hostility to the sport on Fox among non-soccer people, which John Skipper worked so hard to overcome at ESPN, and that hasn't happened at Fox yet. So promotion of the sport, and I know we're talking about the Premier League, which is on NBC, but this is all part and parcel of the same thing, and why maybe soccer's numbers are not improving. I think it's a long season, and there's a lot of excitement about the league in general or about certain big teams, but it's difficult to hold people's interest throughout the season. It's for an August to May season. It's basically an entire school year. If you have kids, your kids are in school the same length of time as the Premier League season. And it's tough for parents. It's tough for people who are into teams to watch every single game. There's so many games in so many different competitions that I think that there's kind of a waning interest there. We see spikes when Manchester United plays, and I think that's a factor too, that they haven't been the dominant team that they once were. I also think, and this is a theory of mine, that La Liga, we see the numbers on Bein have grown pretty steadily the last few years. Not many people are talking about this, but we're talking about La Liga broadcast going from 50 or 75,000 people to like 250,000 people. That is a huge growth on a channel that doesn't have, that is in about 21 to 22 million homes in this country. So I think you're finding a lot of new soccer fans maybe subscribing to Bein and watching La Liga, because at this point in time, it is a better league than the Premier League. And also the Premier League performances, this is part and parcel of the same thing, the performances of Premier League clubs in Europe has been so poor of late that maybe it's an unfair metric to base comparison of leagues on European competition. It's an inexact science. It's not, but we don't have another metric, right? We have no other way of determining what the best leagues are. There is no question La Liga and the Bundesliga, which has very poor ratings, by the way, on Fox, but those two leagues have performed better in European competition than the Premier League the last four or five seasons. So basically, you're in this position where if there are new fans to the sport, maybe they're being driven to La Liga. Now, La Liga, if they get themselves off of Bein and onto a Fox or a Turner or an ESPN in the next cycle, they really could push the Premier League. I'm not sure they'll overtake the Premier League in this country, but I have to admit, Chris, the growth in numbers and interest in La Liga and the growth in BN's ratings on that product have really surprised me the last few years.
Yeah, so two Sundays ago, this is the Sunday that was the League Cup final between Man United and Southampton. We wrote a story about this at worldsoccertalk.com that went deeper into the numbers. But there were two games that showed on that day from Bein Sports on the La Liga side. So they had Atleti against Barcelona, and they had Villarreal against Real Madrid. Both of those games had greater than 500,000 viewers. Most of those viewers were on Bein Sports in Espanol, but one of the games I think was Atleti against Barcelona was at 10:15 Eastern on both.
Right, it was right before.
Right, it was both on the English Bein and the Spanish Bein, and that had I think 600 and something thousand. The Real Madrid against Villarreal game was that one, I believe, if I remember correctly, was only on Bein. Huge numbers from La Liga for, of course, Real Madrid and Barcelona, but in separate games, and just gives you an idea of kind of the opportunity there. I agree with you, Kartik, on some of these things, disagree on some, but in terms of La Liga, that has a huge potential opportunity to grow massively. I mean, you and I know just from walking in the streets or going to soccer practices or games, the number of kids that wear, even Messi shirts or Real Madrid shirts, Barcelona shirts is incredible. There's more kids wearing these types of shirts than any other soccer brand. Yet at the same time, to be able to watch, Real Madrid and Barcelona games, if you don't have Bein Sports, you're out of luck. Imagine if those games, even if it's the Real Madrid and Barcelona games, imagine if those games were on Turner Sports or on NBC over the air or Fox over the air, any of these over the air networks or kind of basic cable stations. Those numbers would go through the roof in terms of now having these kids be able to watch their favorite player in action, on a weekend. Going back to the beginning, Kartik, in terms of soccer's growth in the United States and whether it has plateaued, I argue that it's still continuing to grow, although it's harder to see. So it's the number two most popular sport, I think kids from 12 to 23, I think it is. It's also the number one most popular sport among Hispanics. And with the Hispanic demographic growing incredibly fast, and with these kids, 12 to 20, 23 or so, as they get older, and they're already huge soccer fans, it's just going to get bigger and bigger. It's going to a gradual increase, but it's not going to happen immediately. But where we're not seeing it is we're not seeing it because I don't think there's different pockets of soccer viewers or soccer people in the United States. These kids who are teens that are into soccer, they may not be watching soccer as much on television, maybe a game a weekend, but they're out playing the game, or they're playing FIFA on video games. Yes, they are soccer fans, but they may not be hardcore soccer viewers that just even sit like we do and watch all these great games each weekend. So I think soccer is growing, but the viewing numbers may not correlate with that because, you know, I mean, it's going to take time for those people by the time they reach maybe, I don't know, late 20s, early 30s to be at a stage where in their life they're more casual and wanting to watch sports more so than actually play them and participate in them. I will say though, Kartik, that going back to the Premier League and why have Premier League numbers plateaued, I think we've kind of reached a point where there's two things happening in terms of these games. It's got a pretty cozy schedule where we know most of the games at 12:30 on a Saturday or on ABC. And we've seen more games on NBC this year. But the issue I see that with that too is that illegal streaming is rampant. It's bigger and easier than ever before to be able to watch games illegally. And we know that, I mean, all the numbers point that more and more people are using mobile phones and tablets to watch and laptops to watch games. And it is so easy to find games illegally. It's a lot harder to find them legally and go through all the hoops that you have to jump through to actually be able to watch these games legally. So that has an impact on the numbers. So the viewing numbers, if we were able to look at the viewing numbers and say, okay, now, and this goes for all sports, and this includes MLS and NFL and all those where we've seen numbers kind of dropping. If we were able to add in the illegal streams into these numbers, I think we would find, we'd be shocked at how many people are actually watching, these games that, and now the reported numbers are the legal numbers, but it is what it is. So I think there's a few different things happening there too. You mentioned Manchester United. I think that has an impact on the Premier League in terms of, I mean, kind of the force that they are in terms of just the fan base. But if they're not doing well in the Premier League, that has an impact on numbers. They're the number one driving force in terms of the bigger numbers are those Man United matches. And then last but not least, I think Champions League has a huge impact. I mean, how many years has this been now, Kartik, where we've seen Premier League clubs just falter in the Premier League, in the Champions League in terms of just really poor performances, getting completely kind of outplayed by foreign teams. Bayern Munich against Arsenal is a perfect example. 10-2 in aggregate. That's embarrassing. And it's one of those things that I think it's hard for new fans who are getting into soccer, looking for a team to support and saying, okay, well, maybe the Premier League's the league for me. And saying, okay, well, let me check out Arsenal and see, maybe I'll pick them as a team. And then seeing them go up against opposition, whether it's Bayern Munich or Barcelona and get completely outplayed. And I think it's one of those things that, especially when you're younger, I think we're more likely to pick winners. And that ultimately is hurting the Premier League in terms of growing the fan base and growing the rabid support for the Premier League and those games and those clubs is if they're not doing well in the Champions League, you know what I mean, that's gonna hurt them in terms of, maybe they won't pick them as a team maybe they'll pick Barcelona or Real Madrid again as their favorite team. What say you, Kartik?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think the performances in the Champions League, there are a lot of fans, and I find this kind of hilarious because I've had this argument with more than one Premier League fan on Twitter who say, well, the Champions League, and in fact, one of the fans told me everyone knows the Champions League is not a good determiner of what the best league is. I don't think everyone knows that, but, they make the argument the Champions League is not, you cannot use that as your guide to what the best league in Europe is. Fair enough. However, when the Premier League was ascendant and the Premier League was putting three out of the four semifinalists in the semifinals of the Champions League every year, I used to hear from Premier League fans about how bad the other leagues in Europe were by comparison because of that. And that was their only piece of evidence was, well, Liverpool makes the semifinals every year and Chelsea makes the semifinals every year. Well, they're much better than Barcelona, Real Madrid, Bayern, all these clubs, Juventus, etc. So, you can't have it both ways. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to add one more thing, and I was going to say just a kind of a different tangent too, is that I think the other thing though too that's impacting not just the Premier League, but all the soccer leagues is that there's so much choice now, Kartik. I mean, you can pick and choose. I mean, any of these major leagues are accessible, even minor leagues are so more accessible today than they've ever been. So you and I, say 2006, might have watched, I don't know, if having a guess, 80% of our consuming watching games was probably the Premier League. Today it might be 20%, and the rest of that might be divvied up between, you know, Major League Soccer, USL, NASL, Liga 1, I mean, Serie A. I mean, there's so many different types of games and leagues that we can choose from that must have an impact on terms of the legal viewing numbers of Premier League matches in the US.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is absolutely 100% the case. And there's been an accessibility of other leagues now, or an awareness of other leagues that have driven people to watching those other products. And I mean, I'll admit it. I still watch the Premier League more than I watch any other league, but I don't watch every Premier League game now. I mean, I used to actually even DVR games that were on Premier League Extra Time and go back and watch them after I was done watching the live games.
Channel.
And I don't do that anymore.
Yeah, I used to watch every single Premier League match that was shown on television. So kind of from the Saturday morning, the early broadcasts, usually kind of, we used to have two at the 10 a.m. and then one on the Saturday at 12:30. I mean, so there's usually about six or seven games. Now we get all 10. And I'm picky and I'm choosing different games for different reasons. I mean, sometimes I might switch and watch MLS one weekend or whatever league it may be, but I'm more varied in the type of games I watch and the different leagues I watch than I was 10 years ago. So that's changed. And you and I, Kartik, are probably, you know, some of the hardest of the hardcore Premier League viewers in the US, and our habits have changed.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that all of these factor into why the ratings have not really moved. Jonathan Tanwell, when he was on with us a few weeks ago, mentioned that the all-time highest broadcast for the Premier League on NBC, I believe there might have been a higher number on Fox leading into an NFL game once, but that was many, many years ago. It's still a game from 2014, I believe, right? Early 2014?
Yeah, yeah. Although it is misleading because of that one game that, was it the Liverpool Man United game? It was the one that was on right before the second half was on right before a NFL game. And that number, if it had been an actual full 90 minutes,
Would have been higher.
That would have been the number one most watched game because they aggregated the two together from NBC, SN, and NBC, ended up being a lower number. It was still 1.something million. But his point is fair and accurate in terms of, at this point, you would think maybe 5 years ago, you'd think we'd be hitting, you know, 1.5 or 2 million viewers, and we haven't hit those numbers yet. And I still think, even though there's many reasons why the Premier League viewing is down, I still think that illegal streaming is just having such a huge impact. Just the other day, I was listening to radio, and again, another show I was listening to, just talk radio. Somebody called in to ask the question, okay, well, I have Kodi and I have an Amazon Fire. Is this legal or not? And they said, of course not. No, it's not legal. But it is so prevalent, the number of people, just average people on the streets, that are looking at these devices and buying them and watching all the movies and content that they possibly can want for free. And at the end of the day, those missing out, those losing out on this are the rights holders. They're paying millions, hundreds of millions of dollars for these rights. Yes, they have advertising dollars, and yes, they have money from subscriptions. But at the end of the day, they're the ones that are losing out on this in terms of the rampant illegal streaming that's all over the place.
Yeah, correct.
All right, Kartik, so let's wrap this one up. So for this show, let us know where listeners can find you on the internet if they want to beat you up with some or hit you up with some questions.
Easiest place is KKFLA737 on Twitter.
Okay, and don't forget to send in your comments, questions, feedback, or opinions for us to read out on air. Email is web@worldsoccertalk.com. Twitter is at WSoccerTalk, and Facebook is facebook.com/WorldSoccerTalk. All right, Kartik, lead us out.
Enjoy your football.